It's the most anticipated WNBA season in history.
And you know what that means.
Court is back in session.
Welcome to Queens of the Court, an Odyssey original podcast.
I'm your girl, Cheryl Swoops.
And I'm Jordan Robinson. All WNBA season long, we'll be bringing you interviews with star athletes, analysis on your favorite teams,
and lots of hot takes.
Order, order in the court.
Follow and listen to Queens of the Court on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, and the conversation begins here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Fall is clearly in the air. It's cool out there. There's negligible humidity. It's a delightful morning to be out. No matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Always good conversation, no matter what the weather. And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to be talking with journalist author Howell Wolts. His new book, Restoring America, by returning it to its constitution. This one is for all those folks out there who have complained I'm too liberal. Well, we're going to hear the conservative side of the story in just a bit. Conservative politics and a whole lot more. My name's Peter Solomon, the WIP time, 6:02. And we're back. It's conversation. Our conversation this morning here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio is with Howell Wolts, author of the new book, Restoring America, by returning it to its constitution. My name's Peter Solomon. Good morning, Howell Wolts.
Good morning, Peter. Great to be back on 94 WIP.
Thank you. Folks may remember when we talked to Howell about his book on Dean's getting rid of prisons, getting people out of prisons, but we'll talk about that at another point. Howell, you think, for better or for worse, Donald Trump is America's best hope to be restored to world greatness. Why?
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to spend an evening with him or even have a cup of coffee, but again, I'm an economist, if you recall from when we spoke a couple of years ago, so I tend to focus on results and numbers a little more than emotion. And the guy's track record economically is probably the best our country has ever seen. He's done all the right things to make the economy grow, and I want to glaze over your listeners' eyes with stats, but everything good is way up, everything bad is way down, and all ships are rising. Black unemployment has never been lower. Hispanic unemployment has never been lower. Women's unemployment has never been lower. So if you look at the what's been created and done rather than the hype, he's doing some pretty good things.
All right. How, though, do you credit it to him? Some people would say it was going to happen anyway. Others might say the roots of this were started under Barack Obama. How do you credit it to him?
Well, because, again, I'm an economist, and what Obama was doing was absolutely the worst things you can do. Our economy has enough strength inherently and historically that in spite of Washington, D.C., you know, there can be some good years. But it boils down to something called the multiplier effect. Quick, hopefully not too boring economic lesson. If you leave a dollar in the economy, you don't take it out in taxes, but either put it in or leave it in, that $1, maybe I buy a Philadelphia Eagles shirt from Russell Mills down in Alabama. So they then buy more shirts, and they pay more money to Russell. Russell pays more money to their employees. They go to the store, buy their groceries, buy their gasoline. All of this multiplier effect means that that $1 that remains in the economy and isn't taxed away ultimately creates $4.3 of new economic activity. But the reverse is also a multiplier effect. If government takes an extra dollar out in taxes, and this is, you know, very easily proven economic theory, it has a negative drag on the economy of 1.3. So you've got about a $5.60 swing when government leaves that buck in the people's pocket who earned it, rather than taking it away to waste on the 171 interior designers that the VA has hired when they say they can't afford more doctors. So it's wasted if it goes to D.C., most of it, in my opinion, on things that are far outside the activities allowed by our Constitution, and that's what I'm writing about. So I may disappoint some of your hardcore conservatives. I'm a classical liberal, and my main subject, of course, has been judicial reform with the horrible corruption of our system, which I would credit more to the Republicans than the Democrats. But I realized that after 10 years of writing and speaking and working on that and doing films, that the core problem is that we have allowed our government to escape from our contract, because that's all the Constitution is. It's a contract. So, yeah, I credit him because he did things that make complete sense. And if you think, take it, that multiplier effect, the taxes were cut by $259 billion last year. There's a drag now. You have a dwell time, of course. But next year, even this coming year, we're going to have a $256 billion improvement in government revenue from those tax cuts last year. As this multiplier effect kicks in, you're going to have $1.07 trillion new economic dollars in the economy. So it's pretty serious boom. So it paid for itself the first year when those revenues start coming in, and then that's gravy for the next few years. And I'm just worried they'll do like back when Reagan cut taxes, the Congress, and it doubled revenues, by the way, historically. Again, I was working with them then, and the Congress went out and spent $3, tripled spending. So it was, you know, it just dug the hole deeper. So anyway, some conservatism financially is in order.
All right. You mentioned the tax cuts. A lot of people have a lot of problems with those tax cuts, Sal Howell, in terms of it made the rich richer and the poor poorer.
Well, I understand their argument, but you've got to back it up a little bit and, again, look at the numbers. Nobody making less than $40,000 now is paying a penny. So, you know, you can't exactly say that it hurt the poor or even the middle class that making less than $40,000, because they aren't paying anything now, and they were paying something before. So, you know, again, I know if a guy makes $1 million a year and he got a slight break in his rate of a couple of points, then, yeah, his savings will be bigger, but that's because he's earning more money. But nobody making under $40,000 a year is paying a penny. So that's, you know, which $40,000 a year is wealthy pretty much anywhere else in the world but America. And the median income, speaking of that, you know, it just hit $62,000 last week for the first time ever in history. So again, that's middle class improvement. So, you know, I got to take issue with that. You know, it's a great soundbite, but it just doesn't meet the numbers test.
Okay, but you talked about, for example, cutting taxes, people investing that in the economy. We've cut taxes for the rich, and they're using it to stay rich. Corporate people,
Can you give me an example
sure.
of that?
The corporate people, instead of putting it back in the factory and hiring more people, are putting it in their pockets, buying bigger houses, better boats, and getting themselves bigger raises.
Well, how did unemployment go down if that's what they're doing?
But
there are more jobs now looking for people than people looking for jobs, again, for the first time in history.
But
they didn't put it all in boats and toys. They may have put some of it in. I can't argue with you. I'm sure that it was a windfall for many of them. But there is more money coming back into this economy now. 700,000 part-time and full-time jobs just in the last few months have been opened up and filled. So, and you've got Apple putting billions of dollars back in to America. You've got, you know, nuts and bolts guys coming back, steel factories coming back. I mean, this is some major stuff. Do I love the guy? No. Do I like the way he's lived his life? No. But he's getting beat with a pretty big stick every day, and I'm surprised he could get up in the morning. But I lived in New York when he was really starting to rock and roll back in the 70s and 80s, and you know, he was something else. But I never heard anybody call him a racist. I used to see Don King all the time because he ate in a little restaurant across the street from where I lived in New York, and you know, he was always talking about his friend Donald going to be president. And then I remember when Trump won the Ellis Island Award for diversity and for his hiring practices, which were held up as an example to everyone for hiring minorities. And, you know, on the stage that night with Muhammad Ali, who I also knew when I lived in New York, and Rosa Parks, the lady who refused to sit in the back of the bus, and, you know, winning his award with the two of them. So, you know, I really resent it. I don't care who it is, right wing, left wing, no wing at all. When people unfairly call somebody names whose personal history doesn't justify it, then I'm upset. And you know, I, the guy again, I like what he's doing economically, and some of the other ideas he has are very reasonable if you step back and read our Constitution.
All right. Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the contract that you say we have with ourselves in the Constitution. What are you saying?
Well, we the people, that's us, and we created this government. So it wasn't just a contract with it. We said, all right, we will have a federal government. It will be very limited. Those limitations are specifically listed in Section 8 of Article 1. And then before the states would approve it and ratify it, thank God for Elbridge Berry and some of those guys that you don't even hear about anymore. And Mercy Otis Warren was one of the anti-federalist writers, amazing woman. And her words, I wish they taught about her in schools. Luther Martin, these guys said, no, we're not going to give all this power to a centralized government without 10 things to protect us. And they haggled over that, and James Madison wrote the Bill of Rights. And the 10th one being that, okay, we listed what you can do. So you can't do anything more. The 10th Amendment states it clearly that anything not specifically outlined as a federal duty is withheld for the states and the local people to control. It's pretty simple. So it's not that we can't do wonderful things for other people, but it's at a state-by-state level that is to be done.
Okay.
Is that an unfair thing? Because the Constitution's pretty solid. I mean, I know this progressive movement of the past 100 years and, you know, tried to say, oh, no, it's fluid, it changes with time. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, our founding documents are not, never will be living. There's a finality to them. And I don't think it's a conservative idea at all. This was the most liberal thing ever done in world history. And the original idea came from the Iroquois League and its chief, Kenneth Satego. He doesn't get credit either, but Benjamin Franklin gave him credit and said this whole idea of this representative government, he spoke directly with Kenneth Satego and said, how's the Iroquois League kept peace and calm for all these centuries? And they even had him come to a meeting in Philadelphia and explain to our founding fathers how they should organize this thing. So, but if you take the first tenet there in our founding documents that all men are created equal, then that's final. It doesn't mean that certain politicians get a pass when they break the law violently, or the immunity I talked about in my last book, where judges and prosecutors have granted themselves immunity, even if they knowingly put people in prison and in the electric chair. Which, by the way, since we spoke, there's a study that has confirmed that out of the 5,760 capital trials over a 23-year period, they got it wrong 73% of the time because they so violated the constitutional rights that the case had to be overturned, and on 9% of them, the person was innocent when put to the hazard. So you got an 82% get-it-wrong rate. These judges and prosecutors who are being paid enormous salaries, and they have immunity. So when they get it wrong and kill somebody, it's not murder. It's just, oh, well, we screwed up. So nobody should be above the law. It's not allowed. Take another one of our self-evident truths. that we are endowed with divinity, whatever you want to describe that as being, with certain inalienable rights. Well, that's it. There's no wiggle room or interpretation to the contrary, as has been done. So, you know, you can't take my right to be safe in my home without invasion by SWAT teams and all these horrible things. And you can't take away my right to a trial by jury, which is now the case in 95% of trials in America. You can't do that if those rights are inalienable. So it's not conservative to say, wait a minute, what happened? You know, they got 300,000 ways Congress has created in my lifetime to put us in prison, and almost all of those were written and created and enforced now by unelected bureaucrats, never voted on by Congress. What the hell is that about?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So is that's if that's liberal, it's classical. I mean, if it's conservative, no, it's classical liberal. And let me throw out just one more, which is the real basis of the new book. If government derives its powers, its just powers, from us, the governed, as the document states, the contract, then that's also final. So if they then want to take over, and that's a good example, how did unelected bureaucrats come to have the power to write and pass laws? How did presidents come to have this executive order nonsense? It's not in the Constitution. They can't legislate. That's strictly the job of Congress. So they're all doing it. And now the courts are creating their own laws, like the immunity. That was started with a string of cases, Pearson versus Ray, back in 1967. And now they are completely immune. They could probably shoot somebody in the courtroom and get away with it now. And no judge pays a penalty. Look at Andrew Weissman right now. Do you remember back when he went after Enron and Arthur Anderson, put 80,000 Americans out of a job, got overturned 9-0 on that, and the Merrill Lynch case and all these people he completely ruined, and he hid evidence in every case. Every one of them were overturned 9-0 by the Supreme Court, and they don't agree on much. So what did they do? He should be in jail. He should be hung would be fine with me. He's destroyed so many lives. So what did they do? They put him in charge of white-collar crime at the FBI. So, you know, again, how do these people get away with it? Well, now he's trying to take down a United States president. So, again, it's not conservative to say, wait a minute, we are way off base. This is not what we agreed upon.
Well, talking about taking down a conservative president, you mentioned earlier presidents issuing executive orders. You have a problem with that.
Has no right. He has absolutely no right under the Constitution. It's precluded by the 10th Amendment, but they've been getting away with it since Abraham Lincoln signed Executive Order Number 1, suspending our right of habeas corpus, which is considered the basic foundation of freedom, to know why you've been arrested.
And there's
here's Donald Trump doing it, too, like everybody else. And I've written the White House, because I have written certain papers for them. They're using my last book, Justice Restored, now on the Judicial Reform Committee. So, again, he's doing some wonderful things. Jared Kushner had his own experience when now Governor Chris Christie put his father in prison for something that wasn't illegal. But, you know, so they're doing some good things, mostly behind the scenes. I don't know when they're going to come out of the shadows on that one, but my friend Pastor Daryl Scott, from Ohio, is on the committee. Amazing black preacher, and worked with him on judicial reform for years. I mean, he's got a serious group of reform-minded people, and I'm happy to report that every one of them's got a copy of Justice Restored, and that's sort of the guideline, the book we talked about year before last. So, I hope I'm not disappointing the conservatives that dialed in to hear some wacko that says the man's doing everything right, because he's not.
And I wouldn't call every conservative a wacko either, so let me make that clear. But we can agree, if I hear you correctly, that Donald Trump's use of executive order is an abuse of power.
It is an abuse of power that has been so abused that I don't know how we're going to get rid of it. I'm hoping he'll use it when he has to, and then void everyone back to executive order number one. But I'll give you some examples of how Democrats and Republicans have so abused this non-existent power. They've declared 180 wars undeclared by Congress. And again, the Constitution specifically says that he doesn't even become commander-in-chief until Congress has declared a war. It can only be funded for 2 years and has to be reviewed. That's when the president becomes commander-in-chief, because there is not supposed to be any standing army during times of peace, except the Navy. That was allowed to be fully ready to go anytime to protect us from outside invasion. So, but how about the FBI? Teddy Roosevelt wanted his own FBI to spy on his political enemies, so he went to Congress and said, hey, I want this Federal Bureau of Investigation. They said, no, there's no authorization in the Constitution for a federal police force. You can't do it. So he went ahead and created, by executive order, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Never passed by Congress. I don't even know why they funded it, but they did. And the first thing that they got caught doing was going through Senator Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman's mail, broke into his office like a Watergate deal, and that happened within weeks of their creating the Bureau, and it was put under Napoleon Bonaparte's great-nephew, Charles Bonaparte. He was the first head of the FBI. And then go on forward, all of these horribly illegal 16 spy agents we've got never passed by Congress. Harry Truman created the NSA, which is so un-American. I mean, it should be put out of business tomorrow. He created the CIA, which has done nothing but get us into wars world over and make us probably the most hated nation there is. I mean, we're right at the bottom, according to Noam Chomsky, with Russia in the recent world polls, and the two most admired are China and France. So, you know, we've got some bad bedfellows because of the spelunkering around the world, violating the Constitution. Got to get it back. All of those 16, now 17 spy agencies were created by executive order, not by Congress.
Then where's Congress and these courts been in terms of invalidating these things that are illegal according to the Constitution?
Because they're benefiting from them. All the money that is flooding to all of these military contractors, you look at who are some of the biggest contributors to Congress are, and you see why we have this amazing budget that is bigger than the next 20 nations in the world we're spending every year. It's madness.
All right. And you're listening to 94 WIP. It's Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Howell Waltz, author of Restoring America by Returning It to Its Constitution. Howell, you talk about in your book that the problem has been that we've for too long believed something that started in the 1890s, the notion that America should be ruled by its elites. True or false?
That's true, except for the date. It actually began at Oxford University in the 1870s. A specific professor, his name was John Ruskin. He was a very wealthy but very left-leaning. He was one of the first openly socialist professors at Oxford, and he taught that the British upper class, the elites, were the people that were intended by God, if he believed in one or any of the students did, that they were to rule everybody benevolently, of course, but that they had been qualified with brains and courage and all of these things. Horribly racist. He even opened his lecture each year on this topic by saying certain men are above others. You know, that's the way they were made. And he had a great disdain for blacks and Indians and anybody else. And that was also part of the progressive movement. Well, one of his students in the 1870s was Cecil Rhodes. He was a young upper-class guy. He was so impressed by the speech that he wrote it out longhand and carried it in breast pocket for 40 years. And he and an entire group of Oxford students that loved this idea decided they were going to be the ones to rule it. And they had this young man that was in charge of the military at that time before he became prime minister, Winston Churchill. So along with Winston and others, they got the crown to allow them to declare war on South Africa, the Boer Wars. They took over the gold mines and the diamond mines of South Africa and literally funded their worldwide movement. This is history. You can't make up a story like that. And I know it because they actually had hired a Georgetown professor, Carol Quigley, to write this history called Tragedy and Hope until they realized that the public didn't really agree that they were heroes by taking everybody over with stolen wealth from South Africa. But, you know, Oppenheimer, the big diamond company, Oppenheimer was one of them, and then he runs this operation for the diamonds out of Hong Kong. But imagine having the majority of the gold and the diamonds in the world, and that can fund a lot of madness. The first president, well, Teddy Roosevelt became a progressive, but after he had lost his office. But Woodrow Wilson was specifically hired, funded, and they funded the other two campaigns so they could make him get across the finish line at the end. And he was openly progressive, wrote a book called The New Freedom. We said, I'm against the Constitution now. We're going progressive. We're going to hire professional bureaucrats to run the government, and you just wait and watch. And he did. In 1 year alone, 1913, I call them the three horsemen of the apocalypse. He had the 16th Amendment pushed through because the Constitution also forbids a capitation tax. It was illegal for us to be taxed personally on our income. They did away with that. And then the worst one was the 17th Amendment, because as the Constitution is written, the senators were elected by the legislatures of each state to keep this from happening. That was demanded. And that's the only thing I can find in reading my Constitution for the 1,000th time that the founders said, you cannot change this. You can change anything you want to about elections and the way we do it, but you can never change how senators are chosen. So they were very serious about having the states have their own representation. Think that one through for a minute, because I suggest that we should do away with the 17th Amendment, because if you were the senator of Pennsylvania and your legislature hired you and sent you there to protect their sacred contractual rights in the Constitution, and you didn't do that job, you would lose that job pretty quickly. And suppose that you're allowing all this waste in spending in the government. Well, guess who the tab used to go to? It went to the states, and they had to fund whatever wasn't raised by import duties and excise taxes. So you would never, ever allow a spendthrift federal government to waste so much on nonsense that they have no authority in the Constitution to do. So it was a pretty good idea, and that's when the stop got kicked out. So they changed it so they could tax us to make up the deficit. And also, Wilson pushed through the Glass-Owen Act at the prompting of the people that put him there, J.P. Morgan, Paul Warburg, John D. Rockefeller, the backers, Jacob Schiff, and they took over the private Federal Reserve. It's not part of the U.S. government. It's forbidden by the Constitution. So they gave this private central bank the right to print the country's currency, and then made it to where you couldn't use anything else. So that was pretty slick. So if they couldn't raise the taxes enough, then they could just print money. And let me take a quick departure there just to show you what madness this all is. Are you familiar with what they call the science of money?
No.
How the Federal Reserve can print? They can only print, according to the Glass-Owen Act of 1913, you can only print Federal Reserve notes against debt. So you have to borrow, the government has to borrow money, and with Treasury bills or whatever instrument, and federal securities, and then they have the Federal Reserve print money against debt. So if that makes no sense, you understand it perfectly. So that's why we're in a $20 trillion hole, because they have printed money to expand the economy falsely. It's like putting air in a balloon, and they had to create it against debt. So, again, Trump is starting to reduce the money going into the economy now for the first time in 30 years, maybe 25 years for sure. The economy is booming without the false pressure of adding $1 trillion to, it's like pouring water in the soup. We're going to have water instead of soup one of these days.
Well, but at the same time, by cutting taxes, especially on the wealthy, he's giving us a rising federal deficit.
For the first year, that's true. And what I absolutely fear is that Congress, who is inept, just so inept and untrustworthy, in my opinion, I'll guarantee you that they put budget-busting spending bills like they did in April. It's horrible. I mean, unbelievable. They spent so much money, and they will offset the gains we could have from the tax cuts because revenues will double. I'll make you a bet right now of whatever you want that the revenues will double like they did before back in the 80s. And the spending by the wealthy still when they buy their toys or whatever. It's not all toys, though, or we wouldn't have the unemployment numbers rock bottoming out at present. They're putting it back into factories and other things.
All right.
So anyway, you're going to have a big, big, big flood of new cash, I predict, next year, and you will see that that was an absolutely brilliant move. Now, the trick is, can we keep Congress from wasting it all like they did last time?
All right. Another point I want to make, though, is when we talked about the elites being a bad idea, who's more elite than the Koch brothers, the family that owns Amway, the Mellon Scafies, those folks? Those folks who backed the conservative movement.
Well, let's throw in the richest one there so we can be fair. Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world. Of course, you know, a quarter of his employees are on welfare and food stamps. So let's throw in Bezos. He's one of the big progressives. And let's throw in George Soros, who became a Nazi at the age of 14, even though he's Jewish, and sold out his neighbors to send them to death camps. He's one of the big funders on that side. So, yeah, there's a lot of room for improvement with the wealthy in America at this point. Soros now lives in New York City. So, you know, I got a problem with the way that they spend their money.
Okay. Let's talk about immigration. That's another one that makes a lot of people very unhappy. What are your thoughts on that and how it all fits into restoring America?
Well, again, the Constitution authorizes Congress to make and pass laws regarding immigration and naturalization. So they clearly have the authority. And again, I just resent the press beating up on this guy who's using laws passed in 1996 by the democratically controlled Congress, signed by a Democratic president, enforced the same way by Barack Obama. I mean, they even used the pictures from the camps on the border from under Obama's watch, with crowded with all the little babies and everything. They weren't even from the current times. But now all of a sudden, enforcing those same rules passed by the Democrats have the Democrats enraged. And, you know, again, I just wanted to see what the stats were in Texas for an article I was writing on this topic. So I contacted the attorney general down there, Bill Paxton, and found out that they've started keeping records since 2011. They've tracked, you know, when illegal immigrants commit crimes, not just immigrants, but illegal immigrants. And since 2011, we started tracking it. 1,200 American mothers lost their little babies to the babies of illegal immigrants. And 30% of them were these so-called dreamers who we've got to let in. They're such sweet people. Well, they grew up and murdered 1,200 Texas kids, not counting the 40% murder rate by little illegal aliens in Suffolk County in New York, right there by New York City. So, you know, who's worrying about these 1,200 mothers and their babies that they'll never see again? I was horrified. I have changed my opinion, I will admit, considerably in doing this research. And Paxton went on to tell me that 650,000 of their worst crimes, rape, murder, robbery, not little stuff, not driving too fast or whatever, they have been committed by illegal immigrants. And if you may recall from my last story, I spent 7 years illegally held in U.S. jails and prisons all over America for speaking out. And, you know, I gave my first speech on this topic September 15th of 1977. So it's been going on for a while. And I worked on cases for MS-13 guys. You know, I know these people. I literally lived with them, fought against them, fought with them. I started a Hispanic hunger strike because of the way Hispanics in generally were treated in prisons, so completely separate treatment. But I know these guys, and their slogan is rape, murder, control. And they live by it. And I quit working on their cases because I couldn't believe what they were telling me they had done. And I couldn't help them anymore. So allowing these people just to walk across the border without any control is absolute madness. I mean, I assume you lock your door at night to your house, and until these people pushing for open borders start leaving their own houses open, and why do we need all of these people when our people are just now getting to full employment? I don't give a damn whether the Koch brothers want cheap labor or Walmart's want cheap labor or Bezos, for that matter, wants cheap labor. They should hire Americans and up their price if they have to, but they have to. I don't want open borders just to make the rich richer to make the Democrats have new voters.
But a lot of jobs that are open are jobs Americans don't want to do.
I would completely disagree with you. When you get out of prison, you would take any job because you have nothing. They paid you a nickel a month up it's just ridiculous. Excuse me, a nickel an hour, and that was it averaged $12 a month on the amount number of hours. That's what they used to pay me. So you get out of prison with nothing, with a big scarlet F on your chest that the government's now admitted 82% of them didn't deserve because they got it wrong. And so they would take these jobs in a minute, but you got to mark the box. Oh, this guy is a felon. He was shoplifted in Walmart. We certainly don't want him. So I disagree with that completely. That is nonsense because I know people that would beg for a job digging ditches.
Digging ditches, cleaning toilets, emptying porta potties?
Well, they're well trained. I clean toilets. I clean the shower drains in prison, which let me tell you, is no fun duty when you got 600 horny men using the same four or five little stalls every day. It was horrible. I cleaned out sewers for these people, or sewage pipes. They put me at the worst task because I was writing books and suing them. I cost 27 Bureau of Prisons officials their jobs, or they were forced transfers or other things. And, so I was not very well liked. So every crappy job there was, I've done it. And I would have done it when I got out because I only had $200 and a bicycle. So, and they'd stolen everything I had. So, that's nonsense. And you got 2.3 million people that over the next few years are going to be looking for these jobs as they get out of prison. And I think that the president will be increasing that release rate very, very quickly over the next few years.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Howell Wolts, author of the new book, Restoring America by Returning to Its Constitution. All right. How do you balance then, when you look at the current situation, the division in the country, which seems like we're splitting in part as a people?
Oh, I agree. It's horrible. And, even on Facebook, you can't have a candid conversation, even with old friends, because and this president is a lightning rod, which I think he thrives on. It's like our mutual friend Bob Newman said on your show back in August, the guy, he called it a sinkhole, and he's something. But the status quo of the Bushites and the Clintonites and the Obamaites and all the way back to Daddy Bush, we've had nothing but one progressive disaster after the other. I mean, Bush hired more people and spent more money than ever after running on less taxes and less government. So, they're liars, and then they come in and they get swept up in it, and they've created this 1.97 million federal bureaucrats now that are soaking up, hundreds of billions of dollars unnecessarily doing things they're not allowed to do. So we needed a disruptor who wasn't loyal to anybody and said, okay, I'm going to do what I can to fix it. And he appears to be within the limitations on him. doing what he can to fix it. But I believe you're interested in the Veterans Administration and, sure. and some of the issues there. I read about, you know, your change.org cause. And so I did a little homework there as an example. May I delve into the VA a little bit?
Please.
All right. You know, you remember there was a scandal when 40 veterans died while waiting to see a doctor, and then they reviewed all the records, and it said that there nobody waited at all. And we went back and did some research. A group opened the book. Some friends of mine, a Polish guy, Matthew Termond, and Adam Andrzejewski, they detailed all this. Well, it turns out over 1,000 veterans died waiting to see a doctor over the 10 years before that scandal, and they were calling the VA suicide hotline, which had an automated voicemail server. So I mean, that's not much care for those people. I mean, Lincoln promised that if anybody fought for our country, they would be taken care of. And then that same year, they got $150 million in bonuses for performance. Good performance by letting all his men die. I mean, it's a broken bureaucratic machine. And what really got me was when I found out that they hired, of the 372,614 employees, but only 8% of them are doctors. So I thought, well, what the hell are they spending all that, those billions of dollars on? Well, it turned out just year before last, they hired 3,498 police at $172 million, so they didn't have any money left to hire doctors. Now, when you're in a hospital with people who used to fight for a living and most of them are in beds, I mean, why do you need police? There's never been an incident yet in a VA hospital in history. So you hire all those guys and they say you don't have any money to hire new doctors to stop the waiting time. And then they spent $2 million just year before last on riot helmet, shields, body armor, a cannon system, tactical gear, and crowd control equipment. They could have hired another, almost 1,000 doctors for what they spent on riot gear for a place that's never had a single incident. So anyway, it just blew my mind. They hired 171 interior designers, and one of their biggest projects that cost the most is $16 million just in artwork was for the blind hospital out in Palo Alto. So it certainly wasn't for the men there and the women there that served our country. It was so somebody could make a bunch of money. So you got 171 interior designers working for the VA at huge, huge salaries. The salaries average over $100,000 a year for the whole VA, and you don't have money to take care of the men and women who fought for our country.
All right. Speaking about, go ahead.
So it just infuriates me. And there's nobody on left, right, progressive, constitutionalist. Nobody can defend such wasteful spending for the people who put their lives on the line. I mean, of course, most of the wars in this past 60, 70 years have been, they can't even be described as legitimate. So I think they were to make lots of money for the big boys in the war industry, and they certainly did not benefit America.
Speaking about making lots of money, though, and again, it's a transition, the Emoluments Clause and the people who say Donald Trump violates it.
Well, I've never heard an argument how he violates the Constitution by being rich.
Well, Trump Enterprises making money when foreign dignitaries do things at the Trump Hotel in Washington.
Okay, well, if you want to go all the way, let's talk about the $145 million in foreign government and donor money that came into the Clinton Foundation and was then transferred to the Clinton campaign. Let's talk about that. Did Hillary Clinton benefit from being Secretary of State? Well, maybe not, but her husband sure did, and that money then funneled into the campaign. And Uranium One. I mean, so if we want to start going after them, let's go after all of them. I'm all for it. Let's clean house. But I have a hard time when people selectively decide that he's violating it, but the Clintons didn't. I mean, they left office claiming they were broke, but in prison I also found out that they were given 7 million shares of Aramark, one of the big prison industry suppliers, in exchange for signing the Omnibus Crime Bill, which is what's packed our prisons. And I read that in a prison guard magazine I wasn't supposed to see when I was working in the trash department. So anyway, what has happened to this country? And now these people, of course, are getting close to a billion in personal wealth, and they left public service broke. I don't buy that. So let's open up all the doors.
Oh, I agree. I'll give you that one. That I agree. That's universal enforcement of the laws.
I mean, come on. Some dignitaries stayed at a Trump hotel, or they had a cocktail party there. Well, if I was organizing a cocktail party and he was present, you better bet that I'd have it at Trump Tower if I could. But compare that to making a deal with the Russians to sell 20% of our uranium for $145 million in donations. I mean, you know, Peter Schweitzer's laid it out just so clearly. There is no question mark on that one. So, you know, again, which is worse? You know, and I don't know that Donald Trump is taking the calls from everybody calling in to book a room or a conference hall at Trump Towers. I suspect he's a little busier than that, texting on Twitter and pissing off the public.
Well,
I don't know how you would ever enforce that when the man had to also sign over all control of his business to others before he took this job.
All control to his children, who are probably going to do what daddy says.
Well, okay, but does he have time, really? he's too busy on Twitter. He doesn't have time to take the call from Junior about some Chinese dude wanting to rent a hotel room. I don't believe it.
Anyway. Right. You mentioned Twitter. Some of the stuff he puts out on Twitter just as crazy. When he attacks people, it's at best unpresidential. I mean, there's no law against it, but it's at best unpresidential.
Well, I'm so tired of what has been presidential. Oh, we've got to go into Iraq. They're weapons of mass destruction. Oh, we've got to go invade Somalia. You know, come on. You know, they've done so much wrong that, you know, have somebody calling out the media, which is another one of my huge gripes. And again, that's a liberal gripe. You know, they're so unfair to the guy that it's pretty clever. He wouldn't be where he is if he hadn't gone out and started throwing bombs on Twitter. And I think the red meat based crowd the deplorables, they've gone from Harry Unwashed in Cecil Rhodes' time to deplorables now, that they love it and respond. And I don't think you can drive them away with an axe, when the guy does it, because they're so tired of getting this namby-pamby nonsense from the six remaining media companies that control over 90% of U.S. publishing, TV, cable, movies. I mean, I remember, you remember Ben Bagdikian, just to show you how liberal I actually have been. Ben was one of my heroes. He was a guy that was a Washington Post columnist for many, many, many years. Just, he was left of anybody on the stage today, but an amazing journalist. And he wrote a book in 1982 or three called The New Media Monopoly. And he was the canary in the coal mine screaming, saying, we've got to stop this. There are only 50 major corporations controlling the news content of America. And he wrote the book again just before he died, year before last. He updated it. He's had like 7 or 8 versions. Every time that number going down, 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 down. And now, according to Ben Bagdikian, who I trust with anything figure-wise, because he was just an amazing researcher, he found that 5 international companies, including Bertelsmann in Germany and Sony in Japan, control 82% of the world media now. Now, if you add in CBS and NBC in America and knock out Bertelsmann, because Sony, I'm counting as American because most of the board members now are Americans, so you got 6 companies controlling 92% of America's content. Now, if it was a danger to democracy and our freedom to have 50 companies back in 1983, what is it now when you've got 6 controlling all but a few percent of the content in America? But so that, I think he was pretty wise to bypass. Do I like it? No. It's a, you know, personally, a lot of it's offensive. You know, it kind of makes me chuckle sometimes. It makes me angry others. But he definitely needed to bypass the crowd that's out to lynch him right now, or he wouldn't have gotten anything done or been where he is today. But that's got to be addressed. And I've again written a position paper, a white paper, to the White House and the Department of Justice saying, how can you allow this? Oh, and Bagdikian's greatest discovery, Peter, was he went back and dug all the way back to the owners of these five at NBC and CBS, major news outlets controlling the world's content, and this intentional consolidation, which started with J.P. Morgan and the progressives back in the late 1890s. And 15 of the world's wealthiest men and women owned them. Surprise, surprise. I don't think that's an accident, and neither did Ben Bagdikian.
What are your thoughts before we go, because we're almost out of time, the Mueller investigation?
Well, I knew Bob when he was at UVA. He was a couple of years ahead of me. He was in law school there and seemed like a nice guy. But, again, if you go back and read his history all the way back to the 90s and the horrible things that he's been involved in, I don't know if you remember the Whitey Bulger scandal, you know, the guy that had murdered 16 people right. while he was being handled by Bob's office in Boston. It is impossible for him not to know that. And then they gave him a tip. John Connolly, Bob's right-hand man, gave him a tip and said, get out of town. We can't protect you anymore. Other agencies realize you killed all these people. So Whitey skies out to California. It took, forever. U.S. Marshals finally found him because the FBI wouldn't help. And then Mueller was involved in so much crap protecting the Clintons. He and Comey, Rod Rosenstein, and Lerner were the ones that were put in charge of the investigation back in the early aughts of when the Clintons were found to have brought in tens of millions of dollars of foreign government cash and not reported to the IRS. So they swept that under the rug. Comey goes and gets a big defense job, gets a $5 million parachute, comes back to run the FBI. Mueller goes in as director. Lerner is put as head of the IRS for her service. And Rosenstein, I think we're seeing what he's all about this week. It's finally coming out. I mean, he's going to wear a wire on the president. I mean, my God, who are these people? So I'm pretty disgusted, not just with the waste of money, but, you know, I mean, couldn't Mueller have at least found one Republican to put on it just so, you know, so it looked like he wasn't just overtly. Oh, and the guy in charge, Andrew Weissman, who has been overturned by the Supreme Court more times than they change underwear. Anyway, it just blows my mind how these same crooks and criminals continue to exist. And, they need to clean house.
And I'd like to say thank you to Howell Wolf, his new book, Restoring America, by returning to its constitution. Howell, your book...
And I hope I didn't disappoint your conservatives.
No, I don't think so. Howell, your book is amazing. It gives pause to think. And for that reason
that was the hope. And thank you so much for letting me come back on your show, Peter.
My pleasure. Anytime, Howell. And you've been bye. And you've been listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but talk to you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIPO Sports Radio as we ease on into WIP Sunday, and a beautiful, cool WIP Sunday it promises to be. Maybe at last we can cover up the air conditioner. Who knows? Well, no matter that, we're going to get right to work here on WIP Sunday as we talk with author David Petruzza. He's a prolific author of many things in our history, his newest, TR's Last War. Good morning, David Petruzza. Good morning, David. Hello?
Morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Right. David, you write an amazing number of books on an amazing number of people and issues. How do you describe what you're about as a writer?
Oh, I've always been fascinated by American history and by the American presidency. So it seems there's always a great new topic, particularly the 20th century. I can't say I'm much of a 19th century scholar, but there's Henry Luce, I believe, described the 20th century as the American century. So, you know, things are popping. The federal government is changing. How we look at the world is changing. And we have such interesting personalities, you know, two Roosevelts and Kennedy and Eisenhower and Nixon and Johnson, and just and that's just really almost at the first half of the century, which I tend to concentrate on more because I like to go a little further back, and you get more and more perspective, more and more is discovered in terms of private papers, and more newspapers go online, which you can search and to your heart's content and find very interesting anecdotes and things which are not covered actually by previous historians, because the ease of looking this stuff up is sort of a double-edged sword. You get to find out more, but you get to find, you keep looking and looking and looking because it is so much easier now. So I think it's taking longer to write some of these books than it was 10 years ago. And I don't think it's only a function of my age. It's a question of being sort of too much candy in the candy store of research. But I think it makes for better, much better and more interesting and deeper, if I may say it, works.
All right. What's new, though, to know about Teddy Roosevelt? I mean, so much has been written.
Yeah, that's a great question, because, yes, it's like Lincoln's doctor's dog or something, you know. They've taken just about every aspect of Theodore Roosevelt. But when you get to the World War I period, because Theodore Roosevelt is such an exhausting personality, I think that the other historic biographers of Roosevelt are almost exhausted by him. And they need to wrap the project up, and they need to move forward on that. And so you tend to skip over what is often described as, you know, not the most admirable, or where T.R. is at, period of T.R.'s life, or where he is at his best. You know, yes, he's correct, really correct, in urging more preparedness than Woodrow Wilson is willing to give the nation, because Woodrow Wilson is not up to the task of preparing America to get into a war, and is actually hamstringing some of the necessary efforts. But Theodore Roosevelt knows the power of, to quote a famous quote, speaking softly and carrying a big stick. Now, he's not speaking softly at this point at all. But what he does want is for America to carry a bigger stick, so that when we issue a diplomatic note or a warning to Berlin, they will take us seriously. Because ultimately what Germany is going to gamble on by resuming unrestricted submarine warfare is that they can knock France and Britain out of the war before, you know, America gets out of bed and puts its pants on and gets across the Atlantic and is able to fight the Germans on the Western Front in any appreciable way. And that almost happens, except for the fact that Germany's been fighting a very closely run war for a long time. They've done a lot of desperate things, including injecting the virus of communism into Russia. So what TR is saying is have an army which is bigger than the 83,000 people we have when we go to war in April 1917. Be prepared so we don't have to, as we end up doing, flying in French planes and using British tanks and having our soldiers train with broomsticks on Governor's Island in New York Harbor.
Was, though, his issues based on real concern, based on he was out of the presidency and bored, or maybe even based on a mental health issue?
Well, I think it's a question of all of the above. One of the points I make in writing history is that don't look for just one reason why people are doing something. So on the one hand, it's a perfectly logical and correct motive where he wants greater preparedness. On the other hand is something far less admirable, in that, you know, there was a book a few years ago, not that long ago, called The War Lovers, which was about him and Henry Cabot Lodge and the imperialists of the 1890s, the folks who, you know, were banging the drums to get us into the Spanish-American War. So he is a war lover. He's a fellow who has a real bloodlust for getting into wars. It is there's a anecdote which is told that a fellow named Jack Greenway, who's a big dog sort of out in Arizona and was a rough rider, says to TR in the later in their lives, you know, remember in Cuba where you saw this soldier lying down next to a tree, and he had been shot in the gut or the chest and was dying, and you said, "Bully, this is the best way to die. That's the way I would want to go." You meant that, Greenway says to TR. "You really think that is the best way to die?" And TR bangs his fist down on the surface and says, "Yes, bully, yes. That is exactly right." So he wants to die in combat. He wants to get America into a war, whether it's against Spain or against Germany in the 1890s over Samoa, or against Britain and take over Canada. He makes some wild statements back then where says it would not be a bad thing if America's coastal cities were bombarded, if it would teach America the lesson of preparedness. He talks to the Naval War College in what's been described as the most warlike address in American history when he was Under Secretary of the Navy, and says there is no glory in peacetime equal to the glories found in war. That balances the logic of what he's doing. And also what you say is this a way for him to get back into power, into the national limelight? Because the war starts in August 1914. He's split the Republican Party in 1910 and in 1912. And in 1914, November 1914, what is left of that party is going to be eviscerated, go down in flames in the polls. So he's at a pretty low point in his political life, and his morale is down, and this is a way for him to get back into the public eye. Now, in May 1915, he's engaged in a libel suit. He has been sued by William Barnes of Albany, Republican boss, for charging Barnes with corruption. And he's in Syracuse, and it's like real estate where it's location, location, location. He has the perfect location because he is surrounded by adoring reporters covering this trial. They don't have to rush out to Sagamore Hill to talk to him. And this is when the Lusitania is sunk, when a German U-boat sinks the Lusitania off the coast of Ireland and kills a lot of civilians, both British and American, women and children. And TR is absolutely outraged by this and declares war not so much on the Germans, although he's outraged at them, but he declares it piracy on the high seas, but that declaring war on Woodrow Wilson, who at this time is going to go up to Philadelphia from Washington, address a gathering of 4,000 newly minted, newly sworn in citizens, many of them Germans, and say America is sometimes a nation is too proud to fight. Theodore Roosevelt was never too proud to fight, and these words just absolutely sicken Theodore Roosevelt. Now, it should be pointed out that when Germany marched into Belgium, he was singing a vastly different tune. He writes that sometimes great powers have to do these things to little countries. It's in their interest. And it really doesn't matter what treaties they've written, that America doesn't have clean hands in this regard either, and that Americans should support the administration. So between August 1914 and May 1915, he pretty much flips 180 degrees. How much of that is calculation and how much of that is idealism? It's probably a mixture of the two.
Okay. How did it play itself out, though? his campaign to get America into the war, his campaign against Wilson?
Well, how it plays itself out is we get into war, and we have to, at that point, it's the rubber meets the road. So that America is going to put, you know, a couple million men into arms, and we are going to gear up. But when the war starts, World War I, in 1914, we have a smaller army, standing army, than Chile. So that one of the ways that we do get prepared before April 1917, when America declares war on Germany, is through the activities of a very, very close Roosevelt friend, one of his closest friends and allies. They go back all the way to T.R.'s Washington days as a civil service commissioner and as an assistant secretary of the Navy in the 1890s. And this is a fellow named General Leonard Wood, who is a doctor, trained physician, who becomes a military officer, goes and fights the Indians in the Arizona and New Mexico, you know, in the Wild West. And when war comes with Spain, Wood and T.R. are going to become the big dogs in the Rough Riders at San Juan Hill. And Wood later becomes Army Chief of Staff under Taft. He's certainly a T.R. favorite. Taft maybe appoints Wood as his chief of staff as a favor to Roosevelt. But when war comes, Wood develops the idea that we have to train an officer corps. And he develops the idea, and here and there, one of the camps is in Monterey, California, but the big one is in Plattsburgh, New York, way, way, way upstate on Lake Champlain. And it's a summer camp for upper middle class gentlemen. They're called businessmen's camps. And what he's going to do is take these, essentially bored, but also patriotic young men and train them to be officers. Among them is the mayor of New York City, John Paroi Mitchell, and more significantly to this story, Teddy Roosevelt's older sons, Ted Jr., and Archibald. So they go off, and they are going to be trained in drilling and discipline and tactics and, you know, how to use a rifle, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In early 1916 or 19, T.R. is going to go up and inspect the recruits, troops, volunteers, however you would call them, at Plattsburgh. And when he does, he delivers a very inflammatory speech, considering he is on federal territory, slamming the policies of the Wilson administration and their lack of preparedness. Wood wants to turn these or tone these comments down before they are given out to the press, but they are not toned down because of Theodore Roosevelt's aides. They give out the original unexpurgated versions, and then when T.R. is asked about it, he cranks it up again. Leonard Wood has to apologize to the Secretary of War for this, but T.R. is not an officer, not a member of the Army, and he's T.R., and he again doubles down on what he's saying. So he is just over and over and over again banging the drum for preparedness, saying he is not necessarily for war. And one of the things which his supporters will do in 1916, as the rumors start that Theodore Roosevelt may end up running for the presidency again that year, is to say, and they do this in like four full-page magazine ads, touting Theodore Roosevelt's record. And among them, one of the things they say, which is true and which is very interesting and which is very ironic, that this most warlike of American presidents, in the 7.5 years he had in the White House, that not one American soldier was killed in combat. And of course, this is the guy who wins the Nobel Peace Prize for bringing peace in the Far East between the Russians and the Japanese, while even before World War One sees the American entrance into it in April 1917. American troops are being killed in Mexico. Woodrow Wilson has dispatched American Marines to the port of Veracruz to occupy it. We have had trouble on the Mexican border with Pancho Villa invading and sacking Columbus, New Mexico, and then General John J. Pershing and one of his subordinates, George S. Patton, going into Mexico and chasing Villa down through the mountains and the deserts there, not to mention how many American settlers or citizens in Mexico are really having their property seized or having to flee for their lives or who are killed in Mexico. And they contrast the record of, oddly enough, peace under Roosevelt and death under Woodrow Wilson.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, David Petruzza, historian, author. His new book, TR's Last War. David, I need you to stay with me. We'll be back after some commercials. Be back in just a bit. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, David Petruzza, historian, author. His new book, TR's Last War. You can tell a lot about a man by the women in his life. And TR had two extraordinary women, his second wife, Edith, and his daughter, Alice. What do we know about them and the role they played in these last years, in the last war?
Oh, boy, talk about contrasts. And I guess it's we should say that there's a reason for that contrast, because usually you think that, you know, people who are related are going to have some relation or similarity to each other. But, of course, Edith and Princess Alice are not related, because Edith is the second wife, and Princess Alice, who is named after her mother, is the child of T.R. and his first wife, Alice Lee Roosevelt. Now, Edith is the great silent partner in all this, and she has a great head on her shoulders and is the stabilizing influence in T.R.'s life. T.R. is all, you know, jumping up and down and pounding his fist and charging up San Juan Hill and busting trusts and writing 150,000 letters in his life and God knows how many books, et cetera, et cetera. And Edith is the wise counsel who does not go public in just about anything, but she has enough sense to tell E.R. when he makes the great blunder of his political career, which is on election night, 1904, when he trounces the Democrat Alton B. Parker, that he is not going to run for another term, which makes him a lame duck. And lame ducks, you just take the gun out of the hand of the politician at that point, and people can safely or more safely ignore him. And the Congress tends to do that in his second term. And also it means that he has to turn over the presidency to a successor. He will name William Howard Taft as that successor, and that will, of course, not go all that well or not well at all. She will go public politically later on in her life, long after Teddy is dead. And that is because their relative, Teddy's relative, Eleanor Roosevelt, FDR's wife, has stepped into the race in 1924 between Alfred E. Smith, Democrat, and Theodore Roosevelt, Jr., for the governor of New York, and really tars unfairly and smears Ted Jr. for his involvement, or really non-involvement, in the Teapot Dome scandal. And Edith is going to remember that. And in 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt runs for the presidency against Herbert Hoover, Edith is going to do a very un-first lady-like thing by going to Madison Square Garden and endorsing Herbert Hoover, you know, a real lost cause and a gone goose at that point against Franklin Roosevelt, because the bad blood has really gotten that deep in the family. Ted Jr. at that point is the Governor General of the Philippines under Hoover. And when he's asked what his relationship is with his cousin Franklin, he says, fifth cousin once removed and governor general about to be removed. So the family is split at that point. Now, Alice is the most flamboyant, really, of the Roosevelt family, the longest lived. I think she gets into her 90s. She becomes the famous acerbic doyen of Washington, D.C., and she marries into power as well. She marries a fellow who's a bit older than her from a wealthy family in Ohio, Cincinnati, named Nick Longworth. Longworth will become a congressman from Ohio. And in 1912, he's going to support the Ohioan and the regular Republican William Howard Taft for president versus Theodore Roosevelt, his father-in-law. That's going to cause some family problems as well. But Alice, when her mother dies in childbirth, is going to be, shall we say, inelegantly palmed off to one of T.R.'s sisters just to be raised. But when Edith and T.R. marry, Edith says we should take this child in and raise it as our own, and they do. The relationship is not always smooth, either with Edith or with T.R., and T.R. famously says to people, you know, I can either do one of two things. I can either run the country or I can control Alice, but I can't do both. She's the pre-flapper flapper of America. But she does turn out to be a great supporter of her father in 1912, 1916, really very much in his image that way, and supports his policies as a progressive and also an anti-League of Nations person as that becomes an issue with the end of World War I.
We also can remind people that Alice is Alice as in that song, Alice Bluegown.
That's her. She has a color named after her, Alice Blue, and a fashion. And really, she's strike. You know, the Roosevelt family, T.R., is not a handsome guy, and Ted Jr. is less handsome, but Alice is just strikingly beautiful as a young woman. I mean, the ideal for women at that time of beauty, or going back even into the 1890s, was the Gibson girls. And she could have been one of those. I mean, she just drop-dead gorgeous, really.
I'm shocked at what you had to say about Eleanor, though. It doesn't sound like the Eleanor that most of us remember from history.
Well, Eleanor was falling into it. It really was shocking that she would bust up the family and like that, because remember, she is Theodore Roosevelt's niece, so they really are cousins, first cousins, Ted Jr. and her. She had always had good relationships with the family. When her father dies, and so the person who has to give her away to Franklin Roosevelt is the president of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. This is not some remote relationship here. But she has fallen in with some women in New York as you know, her marriage in the teens around 1917 has become rocky with Franklin. And then there is polio. And she has taken in the 1920s with a bunch of very activist women and has gone off to her own political career. And these women that she's friends with are with the state Democratic committee. So I think because of that, to solidify with them, she supports Al Smith. And throughout the 1920s, really supports Al Smith for governor and his ambitions, so much so that in 1928, when Franklin, her husband, is elected governor of the state of New York, but Al Smith is defeated for president, she says to the newspapers, "What does it matter to me that my husband is elected governor and I get to spend 4 years in Albany if Al Smith has lost for president?" And it's not a question of her being misquoted, because she writes the same thing to Eleanor Morgenthau in a private letter after that, almost the exact same words. So she's really into Smith, and Alice Roosevelt is totally shocked by this as well, not just Edith, but Alice.
Well, I can't remember the quote exactly, but Alice said something about having a pillow on her sofa. If you've got something bad to say about somebody, come sit by me.
Yes, if you've got something bad to say, sit next to me. So she's known as one of the great gossips and one of the more entertaining gossips of Washington, D.C. I was down in Georgetown about a year ago in a rather upscale antique shop or consignment shop, and there was an oil portrait of Alice looking down at me from a great height on the wall. So she's still a factor. She's her spirit lives on in D.C. in the form of her portrait, and also I think of malice and of gossip in the city.
Certainly.
Princess Malice, I guess.
I like the name. It works for me. And we've got to run another set of commercials here. So stay with me, David Petrusa, author of the new book, TR's Last War. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon, into the home stretch with historian author David Petrusa, his newest book, TR's Last War. David, how did TR die? Because you hinted some things that I find fascinating.
Well, TR is the last year of his life. He's a very sick man, and people don't seem to recognize how sick he is because he's indestructible. You shoot him in Milwaukee, and he'll talk for another 80 minutes. You send him to the Amazon, and he should die out there, but he comes back, and he comes back from being a rather weak kid, and he comes back politically. So, you know, it's like people don't see what's going on with him. And in February, he goes into Roosevelt Hospital for a month. He's on a sort of a death watch there. And then he goes into the hospital again, November 11th, 1918. He dies in January 6th, 1919. Comes out of the hospital on Christmas Eve, 1918, and is really racked with pain. He had been operated on in February 1918 on his ears, and loses the hearing in his left ear. So he's blind in one eye, deaf in one ear, and that deafness or the operation wrecks his ear canal, and he loses his equilibrium. He has to learn how to walk again. When he goes into the hospital in November 1918, he is racked by either rheumatism or arthritis or sciatica. The doctors are really not sure what, but whatever it is, it hurts like hell. And when he comes out, he's in such pain, he could not even, at the end, sign his name to a letter. Now, how he dies is, it's supposedly a thrombosis, but current medical opinion is that it's not really consistent with that. And it may be consistent with, now, with a morphine overdose. He was injected with morphine at the end of his life, the evening before he goes to bed. And also, there is a question, which I do not have the answer to, but I merely point out the facts of the matter, that T.R. carried morphine with him on his expeditions to end it all if things became too rough for him, if he was going to become a burden to people. Now, whether he augmented the shot of morphine with the morphine he still had with him at that point, I do not know. But we do know, in terms of his personality, is that we see him as a manic person, but he's also manic depressive. He's capable of getting very down on things and becoming much more depressed than people, casual observers even then would have guessed. And you see his close friends like Henry Cabot Lodge revealing this in either letters, personal correspondence, or in memoirs thereafter. So you also see in his family a string of suicide, an unfortunate tendency towards that, including his own son, Kermit, who kills himself in 1943. Now, just because a person has, say, diabetes or heart disease in the family doesn't mean that everyone is going to have it, nor does it mean that everyone in the family is going to commit suicide, but it does tend to increase the odds. So if one takes a look at those circumstances, one must ask questions. But if TR did not commit suicide, if he resisted that urge all the way to the end, then that will reveal to readers and to the general public the price he had to pay for his glory, or if he did, if he did do this. But if he did resist it, well, I would submit that that was his greatest triumph in TR's last war.
Now, looking at your other books, I want to change gears a little bit and talk about some of your other books.
Sure.
You have a wide-ranging group of books, from The Rise of Hitler and FDR to a story about Arnold Rothstein. How do you choose?
Oh boy, not easily, not easily at all. There are a lot of dry holes drilled along the way, so that there may be titles or topics which do not make it into publication for whatever reason. And also, this book, I had a lot of iterations as to how this might lay out, including like a contrast between TR and Wilson, although that had been done by John Milton Cooper, with The Warrior and The Priest. And I eventually junked that and decided to go focusing really just on TR, so that my previous four books had been electoral histories, that this was sort of a more by, it's listed in the bookstores, you know, shelved as a history, but it could just as easily be listed as biography. And I had done, before launching off on these election histories, 1920, 1960, 1948, 1932, a couple of biographies, one on Arnold Rothstein, the gambler, and one on Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner of baseball and federal judge. And interestingly enough, both of those go into this sort of teens period. So I'm centering, or have been centering a lot, on a certain early 20th century period.
Ever think about writing about a woman?
Huh. No, probably not. I'm not sure why not. Probably because I've written about presidents so much. So that's sort of not yet, and I also don't like to, I don't want to get too close to contemporary history or contemporary events, let's put it that way. I like to go further back so I can avail myself of a lot more material, but that's an interesting question.
Well, it just seems to me there's so many potential women to write about, from some of the earlier first ladies to somebody like Amy Semple McPherson.
Oh, geez, that would be a fascinating story. I've read a couple of biographies of her, and what a wild tale that is. You know, one of my favorite movies is Elmer Gantry with Burt Lancaster, and where they have the Evangelist, which is sort of based on Amy Semple McPherson and the whole situation with her and their disappearance. What a wild, wild story.
Or even some of the old movie stars, but again, that's another story.
I don't think I'd mind that, but not particularly some of the really old ones. I think Gloria Swanson's autobiography is just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, who's next?
I don't know. I wish I knew. I'm actually, this morning I was dusting off a file, and maybe it will be T.R. again. I won't say which period of his life, but it would be, again, an underreported thing. I think that's the best way to go as opposed to churning over well-plowed ground, but to plow some new ground.
And that's an important point you've made a couple of times, and that is there's always new ground on history, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think it is, because people think even if you have come out with a new information or a new take on a topic, that because there's such a famous book on it, that maybe they should just pass over yours. So I think it's best to, two of my most successful books have been on topics really not covered a lot. The book on Arnold, biography of Arnold Rothstein. I mean, yes, there was a fairly successful biography in like 1959, but nothing since, and that was a much smaller book. And my 1920 book, which I think flummoxed a lot of people as to how interesting it was, or how interesting the story was, because they said, "Well, that was a." That was a landslide. There's no drama there. But if you looked at the characters involved and the backstories of all the issues involved, that there really was something there. I was at Book Expo one day and talking. The fellow was asking me, I think another author, what I had written. And I told him this 1920. And I said, yes. And it said like 9 or 10 printings in paperback. And the guy was absolutely flummoxed. He said, 10 printings on a book about the election of Warren Harding? I go, yeah, how do you explain that? I said, I think it's a good book. Yeah. You know? So sometimes you have to, and I think you see a lot of books now on rather small centering. They're smaller books, and they're focusing on smaller incidents on American history and delving deep into them, sort of like Murder in the White City or things of that nature, where people are relearning, I think, what they've forgotten.
Yeah. You mentioned Warren Harding, maybe a book on Florence Harding.
Yes, there was a very interesting book on Florence Harding, a big book by a guy named Carl Anthony. And she's a fascinating person, and I had done a C-SPAN. They were doing a series on First Ladies, and I was called in to discuss Florence Harding with Susan Swain of C-SPAN and with another scholar. And what an interesting story. I mean, there's some her early life and what she overcame is almost like Victorian melodrama, except that it was very, very real.
Well, the quote I remember about her is, "Well, Warren, I've gotten you the presidency now. What are you going to do with it?"
That's right. She was a tough one. I was looking at some newsreel footage of Harding's campaign. I mean, I don't know how much there is of it, probably more than we know. This is one of these things from the Library of Congress online. And you could see Harding looking very, pleasant and Harding-like and greeting people. And then he's standing next to Florence, and he looks really uncomfortable. And it jumped out at me. Maybe I was just imagining it, but his personality or his demeanor changed right there when he was next to her. But when he was just shaking hands, he was like, he was like the small town Hale and Hardy guy.
I think you refer to her as the Duchess, but again, that's another book.
Right.
And I'd like to say thank you to David Petruzza. It's been an interesting conversation. His new book, T.R.'s Last War.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
update.
And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday as well. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. If you can, say thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Ann Tideman Solomon, my associate producer and dear wife. Couldn't do the show without either one of you. Again, stay tuned for Sunny Hill. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.
It's the most anticipated WNBA season in history.
And you know what that means.
Court is back in session.
Welcome to Queens of the Court, an Odyssey original podcast.
I'm your girl, Cheryl Swoops.
And I'm Jordan Robinson. All WNBA season long, we'll be bringing you interviews with star athletes, analysis on your favorite teams,
and lots of hot takes.
Order, order in the court.
Follow and listen to Queens of the Court on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.